Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of the New Books Network. My name is Lee Pierce. I'm your host. I'm an assistant professor of rhetoric and communication at SUNY Geneseo, New York. I use she, they pronouns, and I'm very excited today to be joined by the one and only Brian McCann, and that's Brian with a Y, the way it's supposed to be spelled, whose new book, The Mark of Criminality, Rhetoric, Race, and Gangster Rap in the War on Crime Era, came out in 2017 from the University of Alabama Press. So shout out to Dan Waterman, who is also my editor. We love Alabama Press over there for our rhetoric books. Brian, are you there?
I am there. Thanks for having me and for acknowledging proper spelling.
Yeah. And it's okay if I call you by your first
Absolutely.
Name?
Absolutely. And he, him pronouns myself.
So I just thoroughly enjoyed this book. And obviously, sort of as a person who grew up in the 90s and recently has just sort of like watched a lot of these race issues reemerge in ways that I didn't kind of understand when I was younger, it was very cool to see someone who has both the historical perspective that you didn't like necessarily live through in the same way as an adult as you did now, but also the current vantage point from which I'm also looking. So I really, really enjoyed the way you kind of worked through both time periods in the book and how you have picked different texts that kind of knit through some of the racial issues that we sort of have come to see as solved, but have not been solved in the right ways over the last like 20 or 30 years. And I guess I'll just, have you start with maybe a summary of the book from your perspective or why you wanted to write the book and what you think readers would get out of it?
Sure. I think as a whole, one thing you note is that was actually a really kind of cool experience for me was that kind of reliving, you know, things that I was alive for, things I kind of knew were going on, you know, in the 80s and 90s. I mean, I remember the Willie Horton ad, which was, you know, released by a pro-Bush PAC during the 1988 election and pretty much destroyed the Dukakis campaign. I mean, all that stuff was on my radar, but I hadn't gone to graduate school yet, right, at the age of 8. So it was not on my radar in a way that led to much analysis. So that was kind of a special experience in its own right. In terms of what I see, or at least hope the book does, is I think speaks to kind of two kind of concurrent conversations and obviously the intersection between those. One being kind of the critical analysis of crime and public culture, which is a broad place I kind of position myself as a writer. And the second being hip hop studies, which I'm, you know, less confidently positioned in. You know, I'm more a crime guy who decided to write about hip hop than a hip hop guy who decided to write about crime. But certainly there were kind of trajectories and patterns in hip hop scholarship. And I guess with both bodies of scholarship, something I was wanting to do was confront messiness, engage gray area, right? That so much of what I at least see in terms of rhetorical and cultural studies scholarship about crime and public culture attends largely to what I think I refer to in the book as a very top-down analysis, right? That criminality as a category of performativity, particularly as I'm treated in the book, of performative Black masculinity, is seen primarily, even exclusively, by many scholars as an imposition from above, right? As a mode of oppression, and it is that. Like, there's no getting around the fact that the marking of Black and other racialized bodies has resulted in mass incarceration, premature death, segregation, financial ruin. You know, the list can go on and on. It's also true, and has historically been true, that criminalized populations push back, and they push back with the rhetorical norms of criminality. You know, you could go to the most obvious example being Robin Hood, you know, as your kind of go-to example of a criminal who is fashioned as heroic. A more precise one with regard to this project, and one that I spend a fair amount of time with in the book, is the Black Badman tradition, most kind of wholly embodied by Stagger Lee, right? He was a criminalized Black man who was a centerpiece of post-Reconstruction Black folklore, starting in the South, but steadily making its way throughout the continental U.S. And here you have a very early instance of Black folks drawing on their vernacular traditions to use kind of the criminalized Black masculine body to assert varying degrees of agency, right? To kind of frame it in celebratory ways. So attending to criminality in that way was something I was very deeply invested in. And then I guess the other side of that with regard to hip hop studies, something you see both in terms of political culture, particularly political culture as expressed by white folks, such as Tipper Gore during the 80s and 90s, but still to this day, but also in a lot of hip hop scholarship, is that gangsta rap specifically is very often kind of relegated to this place of, you know, the problematic sibling of the more wholesome artists such as Public Enemy, right, or Immortal Technique, or KRS-One, or Arrested Development, you know, artists that were more explicitly, or still are more explicitly, activist in their iterations. And something I wanted to argue was that, for all the reasons I outlined about criminality, was that gangsta rap has a politics that is more than, but also includes, you know, crass materialism, violence, homophobia, misogyny, playing into anti-Black tropes of criminality. That in addition to doing all those things, it is also engaging in a transgressive performance of Black masculinity and Black criminality that I think has something to teach us, right? The fact that, you know, this genre emerged in earnest during the war on crime is not an accident. And I think by using gangsta as a heuristic, we come to a more complicated understanding of that era and criminality in general.
That's interesting. Yeah, so maybe say a little bit about that phrase, using gangsta as a heuristic. Maybe like, what is a heuristic? Because again, I just don't want to leave anyone behind, because you and I are so brilliant that we get to use all the fancy words.
Right. No. I'm glad you asked. A heuristic, broadly speaking, is kind of a mode for analysis, or a mode for knowing, kind of a way in is often kind of the way I think about it. You know, heuristics more broadly is interested in ways of knowing. So, you know, while the book is definitely analyzing gangsta rap and other kind of iterations of Black criminality, kind of repeated representations and enactments of it, it's also kind of adopting gangsta as an ethic for thinking through and talking about criminality. Right, that, you know, I'm not just saying, okay, here's what NWA, Snoop Dogg, Tupac et al. were kind of up to in the 90s, but here's what they were doing prompts us to approach criminality in, you know, more complex and I think potentially more humane ways. Right, you know, I spent a little bit of time in the conclusion, for instance, talking about Trayvon Martin, because that was very fresh in my mind and a lot of people's minds at the time of the writing. I think you could also include Mike Brown, right, who, you know, was on video allegedly stealing cigarillos from a convenience store before he was murdered by Darren Wilson. And, you know, I think an ethic kind of driven by the ways in which gangsta complicates and troubles prevailing ways of thinking about Black criminality invites us to maybe approach Trayvon Martin's tweets, right? Mike Brown's experience at the convenience store before his death in a fashion that doesn't necessarily turn it into something that needs to be ignored, apologized for, or used to justify their premature deaths. So it's both object and method.
Yeah. And I mean, and it's an important point because, you know, when we think about a lot of the activism that's come out of Black Lives Matter over the last couple of years, one of the big things is to try and give depth or sort of complexity to these pathologized, criminalized versions of these Black men, which is how typically, like, kind of we've come to expect them to be, like, made. What's that? Oh, it's that horrible joke. They make it in The Wire whenever there's, like, no. What is? It's an acronym for when there was no civilians involved in a death.
Oh yeah.
But, no, but sometimes they'll extend it to include, like, gangbangers because they don't really consider them, like, lives having been worth law, like, worth mourning. Yeah. And so one of the things I know with Trayvon too, there's been this campaign that on his birthday, you're supposed to tweet something about his, like, identity aside from his race or his criminality, right? He loved math. He was going to do this. He was going to do that. And so there's a kind of way in which, like, the opposite of criminalizing these individuals to make them disposable is to kind of decriminalize them. But you're sort of saying, well, but there's a way in which, like, we forget that the mark of criminality has a rhetorical history, and the opposite of bad, we'll call it, like, negative criminalization isn't necessarily to decriminalize. Like, for example, it might be something to be like, so what, someone steals cigarillos from a convenience store. Does that make them, like, murderable by the law? Like, right. Like, that's the question, not just, oh, no, he was actually a really good dude. It's like, well, but that just reinforces the idea that the criminality can't be ever be anything but just a net negative.
And that there's a very kind of normative idea of which lives are valuable. Right. Jeffrey McCune, who's at Washington University, was at LSU, my institution, a few weeks ago. And he was kind of making that point about Mike Brown that, you know, when we remember him, it's as a potential father, right, as a son, as a. And what potential futures does that erase for someone like Mike Brown? And I think similarly, the, you know, wanting to subordinate the criminal, right, as a performance does that kind of work as well. You know, if he's not wholesome and angelic, he's not grievable.
Yeah, I mean, and I think imperfect grievability becomes kind of like an alternate theme for the mark of criminality in this book that I really liked. Do you want to say any more about, because the mark of criminality kind of is the driver, because of course it's the mark of criminality, and you use, I wish people could see it. The hoodie graphic, the sort of like amorphous human being, that's a black silhouette in the hoodie, but the way it's like, it uses white lines to outline the hoodie instead of kind of, so there's a weird way in which it's like binary colors instead of just the all black hoodie that we're used to thinking about when we associate with Trayvon, is sort of a cool, like, that's one way that the mark of criminality gets circulated, right, is in this image. And it was a great choice for the cover of the book.
Thanks. Yeah, and I was super pleased with the work they did. I mean, Dan Waterman and I, who I agree is a marvelous guy to work with, kind of had this broad kind of conversation about really wanting this kind of silhouetted hoodie figure. The work the people over there did was just, when he sent it to me as a JPEG, I'm like, all right.
It's perfect.
I'm happy. Yeah, it's kind of a funny story because and I think this is true with a lot of, I know, my writing and probably a lot of other folks, is that, you know, the thing that ends up being kind of central to the project isn't always the thing that you think is going to be central to the project.
Yeah, I hear that.
I mean, mark of criminality, I think it was something I used like in one sentence, like in an early draft of the introduction, and you know, a colleague who was looking at it was like, this is kind of rich. I like this, you know, it just has kind of a powerful sound about it. It feels very descriptive, you know, it kind of conjures, Scarlet Letter, other kinds of, you know, ways in which bodies are marked, resonates with, you know, people like Ron Jackson and scripting of the black masculine body and things along those lines. So, you know, I kind of decided to kind of blow that up and expand it. And that became kind of the key thematic throughout. And it really wasn't until the point at which reviewers were giving me feedback that the turn toward genre and affect really took off. So, you know, in so many respects, and I always like to underscore this, both to, you know, give credit where credit's due, even though I don't know who the reviewers were, but to also highlight that, you know, all writing is collaborative. the kind of life of an evolution of market criminality as a concept, had a lot of hands in it, right? It was a collaborative practice, but I think fundamental to it is, you know, over time as I've gotten a sense of what really interests me, crime and culture is one of them, but so is, and kind of one way I think about it is capture and escape. It's just kind of the ways things travel, yeah, whether they're tropes, narratives, bodies. You know, they move around, they get pinned down, but then they wiggle their way out, and you know, so, to some degrees are captured, but there's always something that's kind of leaking out. There's some sort of remainder that doesn't quite sit still. Kind of tracking those dynamics through public discourse is something that always appeals to me. I'm just fascinated kind of by those dynamics. And, you know, having kind of the marker criminality as a tool for kind of naming and charting that was really helpful, because, you know, much of what I'm doing is, you know, thinking through the ways in which Black masculine criminality finds expression, is captured, escapes, you know, is contested, and, you know, being able to name it and define it and do so in a way that attends to its consistencies as well as its malleability was pretty essential to tapping into that flexibility that I think really, really underwrites it and makes it interesting.
Well, yeah, and I don't know, and you may talk about this in the book. I mean, sometimes I have to spot read just because I read so, even though this is one of those books that I actually was like, man, I really wish I didn't have to interview about this because I could actually read the entire book and take like my time. but, you know, that phrase mark is a target term, right? Like, so, but it's also like, it's also kind of a derogatory, like, you know, like a mark ass trick, which is just, it's like a Black English vernacular term that I just like know from around the way. But so there's this way in which the mark of criminality is like also them being marked and them mark, but them marking. And so the mark was a cool noun there because it's like a double mark, because you are marked, but you also use it to mark. And also you wield it to say mark, right? So it was like, it's like very cool. I mean, yeah, stumbling upon that was definitely genius. Whoever pointed that out, you should thank them, because I thought it made a great sort of like theme for the book.
Yeah, it was very helpful. And I think you're right, that theme in other iterations shows up too. You know, I'm thinking of Ibram Kendi's book, Stamped from the Beginning, right? You have these various,
mm-hmm. right, yeah.
You know, whether it's marking, stamping, what have you, or scripting, to go back to Jackson's work. Just this way of thinking through the ways in which discourses are put on bodies. I mean, in many ways, it's just a generative way, I think, of mobilizing and packaging an analysis of performativity, which I think at the end is.
Yeah. Yeah. And not surprisingly, that word targeted shows up a lot. So I think especially like when you're talking about Nixon and his war rhetoric, the overblown war rhetoric, you know, it's like he targets these racial and class inequities, but then he targets certain social welfare programs. And of course, like he targets the very people that he's right. So he conflates the cause with the effect. And then as a result, just kind of undermines the entire mission of the welfare state, which sort of then creates the socioeconomic crisis that gangster rap sort of emerges into. Yeah. And I don't know if you want to talk more about context, because, you know, the war on crime rhetoric is kind of really familiar to rhetoricians, because so many of us kind of see it for what it is. But a lot of, you know, I think for a lot of people, it was just like, oh, well, but isn't there a war on crime? Like, isn't the crime really bad and we need a war? And it's like, well, yes. And also it was made up. So it's sort of like maybe some people at home don't necessarily have the same vantage point for this that you and I do.
Yeah, I think there was, I mean, context figured. Yeah, I mean, it does in all criticism. I think in this one, in a lot of respects, because there were so many elements of context that I felt warranted attention. And I mean, there's a lot of stuff that didn't make it in, right? I mean, that could have, you know, gone way back to, you know, feudalism, right? To you know, talk about, Peter Linebaugh is a great historian who I like a lot, and he kind of frames theft as a mode of class warfare. You know, that emerges as we know it today out of the emergence of private property as capitalism kind of crushes feudalism, and we enter into this new new economic period. So, yeah, but there wasn't room to talk about feudalism in a book about the 80s and 90s. Go figure. But in addition to attending to kind of the specific historical elements of, you know, what was going on in the 80s and 90s, and then stuff such as Nixon kind of on the lead up, which, you know, was vital both to give that context, but also I always think, and this is important with a lot of matters of social importance, but I think particularly with the war on crime, you know, recognizing that, you know, it's not sufficient to pin this on Republicans, right? That this was a bipartisan project by a number of very powerful white, primarily men, pushing for mass incarceration. You know, Bill Clinton is responsible for incarcerating a lot of black bodies.
Yeah. Oh, yes. And let's make sure we all just go ahead and take a minute for my leftists out there and just acknowledge that, yes, Clinton was a huge part of this. Okay. Yeah, that's an important, it's really right. Thank you very much. It's really important to remember this has been like a bipartisan, longstanding dismantling effort.
Yeah, no, it's been around for quite a while, and the usual culprits are convenient and important ones. I mean, Nixon deserves a share of the blame for sure. He's not alone though. But when you're, you know, and this is where kind of my background in my commitment to an ethic, you know, informed by cultural studies became very important, because, you know, when you're talking about a musical genre, particularly a musical genre that relies so heavily on sampling, context takes on a whole different element, right? Because you're not only, at least for me, you're not only attending to, okay, what's going on in South Central Los Angeles during the 80s and 90s in terms of, you know, Daryl Gates's LAPD, the riots / uprising after the Rodney King verdict. You also have, I mean, the sampled music itself contributes to the context, right? The fact that you've got these young black dudes writing lyrics that are making their elders just cringe, right? In terms of what they appear to be celebrating. At the same time, they're also sampling the musicians who provided the soundtrack for civil rights, black power, etc. Right, so that kind of weaves into it this generational tension that also played itself out in a lot of more conventional public discourse. So, you know, I found myself just kind of realizing there's this very, very diffuse and very multi-layered genealogy that's certainly rooted in political history, but also, you know, pop cultural history. And that's where, you know, Stagger Lee as a folkloric figure comes in, where blaxploitation as a film genre becomes very significant. The release of the film Birth of a Nation, right, is a really important centerpiece. And also understanding kind of the context of the industry, right? So, you know, in the chapter about G-Funk, right, where I'm talking about Dr. Dre and his solo work and Snoop Dogg, you know, there's the video for Who Am I? What's My Name? I may be butchering the name of that song. I'm maybe blanking on it. You know, in the video, you have, you know, a lot of outdoor parties. You have dog catchers chasing the dogs that Snoop Dogg just turned into along with his dog pound. And, you know, I was watching this several times, and it suddenly occurred to me, I'm like, wait, this is the Straight Outta Compton video, right? It's you know, whereas the Straight Outta Compton video has police chasing NWA throughout the throughout Compton, in this video you have dog catchers chasing young black men who have magically turned into dogs, right? Also throughout South Central Los Angeles. So knowing that is, you know, for me, kind of vital to really understanding the richness of what is going on. And the song in question is Who Am I? What's My Name? I think I might have flip-flopped the two. Okay, good.
Yeah, and so there's like two directions to go there. One is you bring up Stagger Lee, who some people actually may not know who that is. And also earlier, by the way, I said my listeners at home, that's really normative. My bad. It's a old radio lingo. I just meant the listeners. You can be not in your home. I'm sure lots of people listen to this who are not at home. So I just want to make sure that I'm not like implying that you can only be a home person if this works. But on top of that, the Stagger Lee may not be familiar. And also you kind of do a really good job, I think, early on linking this up with sort of like the African folklore trickster character. As sort of like you're kind of borrowing from that tradition / the mark of criminality sort of is part of that tradition, even if it's a very like specific iteration of it. So maybe we could do a little bit on that since you brought it up before we kind of move back into actual examples, I think, from the gangster rap era like Snoop Dogg, which I think will be really helpful to drive your point home.
Mm-hmm. I really love digging into the folklore bits. This was not stuff I was immediately familiar with. I was familiar with Henry Louis Gates's work on the Signifying Monkey, and knew about black exploitation cinema and a lot of other things, but that kind of transition from the trickster to the bad man was something I wasn't keenly aware of. And I mean, gangster, to be clear, has elements of both, right? So, you know, the trickster engages in irony, in semantic reversal, in trickery, right? So various trickster figures are often, you know, animals who, you know, are able to use various forms of hijinks to fool a more powerful animal, right? Or pit two powerful animals against each other. So there's the Signifying Monkey, Br'er Rabbit are kind of two examples, well-known ones that come to mind. And this kind of folklore worked particularly well as equipment for living on the plantation, right? Where certainly there were escapes, there were insurrections, there were forms of resistant violence on the plantation by enslaved folks. For all slaves to engage in those forms of rebellion or resistance was to take serious gambles with one's life. As they were during the Jim Crow era and the very present in terms of black and other racialized bodies. So stories of the trickster accentuated and celebrated, you know, the notion of outsmarting or outwitting the slave master, the guard, whoever it happened to be. And, you know, it provided this kind of hidden transcript that enslaved folks were able to, if nothing else, just kind of get some life out of by telling and conveying these stories through the oral tradition. But after emancipation and the, I don't want to say collapse, the annihilation through white terrorism of Reconstruction, you see a decided shift from, you know, kind of the joyful, ignorant slave to a heavy accentuation of something that was already there, which was the sexually aggressive black masculine body who, now that he is free, is going to come and rape all the white women. And that needs to be contained, right? That is one of the kind of chief narratives of Jim Crow and contemporary anti-black racism. And it's at that time that you see Stagger Lee, Dolomite, and other bad men coming in full force, right? They are hypersexual, violent black men, some of whom are based on actual stories. So, you know, Lee Shelton or Stagger Lee was a real man who did, in fact, shoot and kill a guy named Billy Lyons at a bar in St. Louis during the late 19th century and, went to jail. Just led a life, but he gets made into this kind of bigger than life figure because there was something about it that spoke to that kind of current exigency, right? This period in which, you know, the ignorant slave turned into the black ravenous beast, and Stagger Lee became, you know, a beast that was turning the discourse back on itself and providing particularly black folks who consume these stories an opportunity to even vicariously experience kind of modes of agency. A lot of the scholarship on not just folklore traditions, but also the history of Mississippi Delta blues, which in many ways was a precursor to gangster rap, you know, talks about how, you know, fantasizing about doing violence feels good, right? Especially when you're
Yeah, after, especially when you're the recipient of violence for like centuries.
No, there's a catharsis to it, right? I was watching an intense and kind of traumatizing battle scene last night in Game of Thrones. But a lot of times, like the battles on a show like that or on an action movie, you know, they just feel good, you know, watching stuff blow up. But then certainly when, you, as you say, are subjected to, you know.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Generations of violence up to this point. There's a certain joy in enacting the various transgression with which you are associated.
Yeah. You did your work there, right? You linked up this with its sort of rhetorical context, which I appreciated, not just in the sense of the political landscape, but also that the mark of criminality and gangster rap don't come out of nowhere. And even the, you know, like even the iteration of Snoop Dogg back to Dr. Dre, which then becomes sort of like back to outwitting the slave, right? It's really cool for you to have traced that trajectory. So I think it's good we went back over that terrain.
Yeah, I mean, I think it puts the genre in a very different context and perspective that highlights its the political work it's doing, even if it's not self-consciously political work.
Right. Well, and it also, I think, helps to course correct for this issue that you kind of point out a couple times, you know, in the beginning of the book, and I'm not surprised, is like, what's a white... In fact, for the audience listening, the preface to this book is titled, what is it, White Boy Listens to Gangster Rap? Yeah, the white boy listens to gangster rap, and you sort of talk about how growing up this was kind of not your genre, and then you kind of get involved with it as part of sort of a political awakening around some activism work you did for someone who was falsely imprisoned or overly sentenced. I can't remember what the word is that you use, and that one of the challenges of writing the book is that you have the argument, but you're white, and so one of the ways I think that you prove that you kind of like make. Not make up for it, but one of the ways that you mitigate that as sort of a potential like resistance point for your reader is you do the work of linking up the mark of criminality with sort of the African folklore tradition, because that's how you sort of, not that everyone shouldn't do that, but there's a way in which kind of like that's how you earn the entry point into making this argument for an identity group, like on whose behalf you don't speak. So I thought that was important too for people that are, because, you know, I'm sure there are people out there listening like, I don't know, this guy sounds kind of white. What's he doing right about gangster rap? So I just want to point out you did your homework, and I think that matters.
Thanks. Yeah, and that was, I mean, and like you said, I mean, scholarship should always do that, right? I do think though when we're writing across experience, demonstrably engaging in that labor is an important ethical move.
Although it's interesting now, because I think about, like, as you were talking, I was thinking about all of these sort of this new generation of rappers like Drake and these people, I mean, who have come up, and you wouldn't call them gangster rap, but since gangster rap kind of isn't in existence anymore, it's been replaced by much more of this, I think, like cerebral kind of, like just more of a, it's the genres are blurred a little bit more. And one of the criticisms a lot of these people get, like when you think about like Wiz Khalifa and, who's the other one? I was reading this article earlier about the 10 softest rappers in the game, and they were all the big 10 best-selling, but none of them have had like criminal records. Like very few of them have gone to jail. I mean, I think like T.I. went to jail for like a gun possession and got like 18 months, and now he's back making Marvel movies. And so there's this critique of them as like not really having the credentials to to have the mark of criminality. But in a way, it was kind of always performative. It's just that it was much less performative, I think, for people like Eazy-E, who, you know, like people in NWA were a little bit, I think, closer to what we might call authentic. But it was always in some ways kind of not about authenticity anyway. It was about tapping into this historical tradition of sort of like speaking truth to power through this non-conventional avenue.
And that's something that I found myself tossing around in my mind a lot, right? That, I guess asking the question of just kind of what the relevance of the project to a contemporary audience, especially a contemporary audience that is, you know, very much immersed in a conjuncture that includes Black Lives Matter, that, you know, witnessed George Zimmerman being acquitted for the murder of Trayvon Martin and a range of other experiences. And I think in that respect, I think that's why, among other things, it was important in the conclusion, for instance, to kind of take a step back and accentuate the fact that, you know, we're not exclusively talking about gangsta rap, right, as the only site of performativity with regard to the mark of criminality, right? That there are other places and modes in which this happens, and it was true prior, right? For a period in the 70s, it was film, right? By way of blaxploitation. So, you know, putting it in conversation, I guess, with the present moments was its own challenge. And you actually just reminded me of, every spring I teach a class called Crime, Communication, and Culture, which is basically Brian gets to teach about his research interests for a semester and enjoys it.
That's every semester for me, so no shame in that.
And, you know, we were talking, I have an entire unit where I talk about Stagger Lee's kind of the focal point, but then I kind of link it back to, or link it forward to hip hop, right? And, you know, I'm in a room with, you know, students who for the most part were born in, like, you know, were born the year that Doggy Style came out, right? I mean, they're youngins. And one of the things that really kind of blew my mind this year was learning just kind of how not many of them really take kind of those very conspicuous enactments of masculine criminality in hip hop that seriously anymore. Like they don't, at least, I mean, and this is, you know, a sample of 20 students at a large Southern university in the US, right? But, you know, because there's a few local kind of New Orleans and Baton Rouge rappers, right? Like Kevin Gates, Boozy Badass, and some others who enact what, you know, I would characterize as the mark of criminality. Or before he went to prison, See Murder. Chicago also has a hip hop scene that's very bound up in a lot of quite tangible criminality. A lot of fatal shootings. A lot of imprisonments. I'm born and raised in the Chicago suburbs. So
you're kind of from both ends.
Yeah. But my students just were not taking it seriously. And this kind of spanned gender and race in the classroom. So it kind of raised this interesting question just in terms of kind of what is a performative's shelf life, right? And when does it move on to another form? When does the musical genre that, you know, most often embodied it have to, or not have to, but it adapts and it changes. And sometimes someone trying to do what, you know, Eazy-E did very persuasively in the 80s and 90s doesn't do it as persuasively for some audiences.
Yeah. Well, and you're right. Cause to me, this book feels so relevant, but of course I also grew up with a lot of these artists. So, I mean, I guess, yeah, from a vantage point as somebody much younger, why would you? So I do think the tying it to Trayvon Martin and sort of the sort of newly emerging marks of criminality that are not necessarily gangster rap, but aren't part of that trajectory was really, really astute move on your part. And of course it was a question that was begged by the book. So you aptly probably knew you weren't going to get away without that answering that question. Yeah. Well, so we've kind of referenced a lot of these artists. Do you want to maybe dive into a specific, maybe an album cover or a specific kind of artist? I mean, there's a lot of them, right? You've got Snoop Dogg, you've got Tupac, you've got Eazy-E, all the members of NWA. So we talked maybe about the NWA Straight Outta Compton, because it's kind of the most, it's had sort of a current renaissance, but we could really talk about any of these particular performances of the Mark, since we've kind of gotten the theory, I think, pretty well established.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, NWA was the first one I kind of dove into, and because it as the project kind of took form, it just took on a chronological form. And, you know, NWA was by no means the first rap group to kind of engage in gangsta tropes, but they were the ones who kind of perfected it, right, and turned it into something that was, you know, had mass market kind of crossover appeal, made a lot of money, and inspired heavy reaction from the FBI among other people. In a lot of respects, though, you know, the second set of case studies, right, where we're talking about Dre when he goes solo, and then when, you know, he kind of recruits Snoop Dogg, and Snoop Dogg pursues his own recording career. I really enjoyed working through that one, because I think in a lot of ways it had some of the richer context, right? Because you had the Los Angeles uprising, you had kind of very in earnest kind of escalation of the war on crime. You know, Clinton is elected for the first time in 92. And he's president during the Los Angeles uprising. So, you know, there's a ton of moving parts there that make it really fascinating. And another part of it that always struck me was, so NWA and many other gangsta artists. So, you know, a Southern example of gangsta rap at the time would be the Ghetto Boys, right? And they're kind of, the aesthetic of their music is very, very aggressive, right? It sounds violent. It sounds angry, right? And that was certainly true of some of Dre's work, and Snoop Dogg had a couple tracks on Doggy Style that had a very kind of were performing in an angry register. But the most of it was joyful. I mean, it was just, you know, if you look at the videos for, you know, any Dre or Snoop Dogg single during this period, and a lot of G-Funk work, right, at that time.
Oh yeah, especially if you think of the B-level artists like Warren G and Nate Dogg. I mean, they were very much just like, they, when you make a point at some point that like some of these songs in the Chronic and some of this kind of start to this leisure, like the leisure, and the, so it becomes less about like crime as a means of like economic, right? It's kind of weird because it starts to become almost comfortable and cool and less sharp. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I guess a lot, because a lot of these, a lot of the songs featured on many of these albums, and also the ones that were not sort of major successes, but minor successes that haven't withstood the test of time, they're very kind of upbeat and sort of almost like joyful about the whole entire ordeal.
Yeah, and it's coming in the midst of, you know, this gang truce movement after the riots, and also in the midst of this crackdown on, among other things, outdoor parties. And
Will you go back to this? Because I didn't know this. I thought this was really cool. Will you go back to the truce after the riots and then the like anti-cruising, no party legislation thing? Because this was really neat and I didn't know about this before.
No, neither did I. And where I got a lot of the context for this is, you know, if folks listening, who are interested in kind of the political economy and history of hip hop, another book that I think can be very useful is Jeff Chang's Can't Stop, Won't Stop. Jeff Chang is a music journalist, and his book was really kind of indispensable for me in terms of some of this historicization and this piece in particular. But after the uprising, after the Rodney King verdict and everything, there was this just very palpable shift in LA, particularly in South Central, and there was a somewhat short-lived, but actually at the time quite successful truce movement between varying rival gangs, most conspicuously the Bloods and the Crips. And even police admitted that it was effective. that you know, gang-related violence at the time was diminishing quite significantly. And even a lot of kind of reformed gang members. So, you know, someone else I've written about in the past is Stanley Tookie Williams, who was a co-founder of the Crips and was executed for a murder that many folks, myself included, believe he didn't commit. And while on prison, he, you know, atoned for apologized for founding the Crips and became this anti-gang activist. And he was an anti-gang activist who had no interest in working with the state, right? He did not want police involved. He did not want.
Well, sure, because they, probably in his view, they're a gang. I mean, in a way, right? So, yeah. Oh, sorry, I just knocked my table. So, I got so amped up, I just start throwing shit. You know what I mean?
Love it. I don't know. I get there. I do that. So he's kind of one exemplar of, I think, this kind of broader kind of pattern of, you know, kind of community oriented work among many marginalized communities who definitely, you know, are seeking the resources that they are entitled to from state actors, but don't see particularly the carceral state as an entity that's going to solve problems, right? That it needs to be, you know, in this case, gang members working together to improve things. So, you know, that truce movement played itself out in a variety of ways. And one was leisure, recreation, style, right? And, you know, outdoor barbecues and parks in cities such as Los Angeles. And, you know, when black bodies assemble, white people tend to get freaked out. And that's what began happening, that, you know, the LAPD kind of formed this narrative in their head that, oh, this truce really is just the gangs joining forces so they can come after the police, right? So they can, you know, kill more cops, even though they weren't killing a lot of cops at any point, right? You know, police officer fatality rates consistently are fairly low relative to other jobs and you know, the narrative of the cop killer, right? It was a revenge fantasy for a lot of rappers, and it was a, you know, anti-black paranoid fantasy for a lot of white folks. So, you know, the very leisure practices that were kind of giving expression to this truce movement then became criminalized by the state, and also by other institutions, right? Schools, for instance. And this I actually remember quite clearly, you know, going to middle school and high school during this period, you know, heavy kind of regulation of sagging jeans, you know, various colors that could be worn.
Yep. My high school had such a big, that was at 90. Yeah. So it was a couple years later, but these were older laws. But when I remember being in high school, there was a lot of these regulations, and I sort of knew at the time they were gang related, but I thought about this when I read the book.
So yeah. So black youth, in terms of their enactments of, you know, various vernacular practices, became itself criminalized. So we're no longer, you know, talking about, you know, drug dealing, violence, etc. We're talking about playing music. We're talking about driving a low riding car, you know, around town with no particular destination. Things that, again, have always been true, right? You know, the history of the LAPD and a lot of other police departments are bound up in, among other things, that, you know, historically black neighborhoods tend to be neighborhoods in which folks, you know, hang out in front of the house, right? Gather on the street together. You know, I mean, here in Baton Rouge, that's in many people's minds a marker of a dangerous neighborhood, right? that you have, you know, black bodies assembled out front rather than, you know, in primarily white neighborhoods. You know, we hide in our backyards, right? So, you know, white folks don't always know how to read historically black leisure practices, and as a result, you know, go to the most readily available tropes for it. And one of those readily available tropes is that of criminality. Right. So
have you read Brad Vivian's stuff on the topoi of witnessing, the commonplace witnessing?
No, I haven't.
Well, it's interesting too, because I was thinking you could almost, I mean, based on the book you wrote, you could almost make an inventory of all of the things that white people are scared of that they think means black people are out to get them. And you can see it just repeated, right? I mean, this book is almost an inventory of, here are all the things that we're always reading as criminal that really, like, I mean, I don't know. It'd be interesting to see the stats on how many police officers have been shot responding to violent reports from black neighborhood barbecues. Like, it's got to be pretty low, right? It does, however, and this is a weird, totally off tangent, but I'm just so into like the 90s. It does give me kind of a new respect for the movie Friday. Oh, which yeah. I sort of always never really like. I liked it because, you know, I was from my time, but I don't know. I don't know that I necessarily like, loved it the way that other people loved it. But there is this way in which it's kind of, it makes highly legible some of these leisure practices that could, right? They could kind of like, it's sort of like the other side of what is being shown in like these gangster rap narratives that, of course, in some ways just reinforce what white people kind of were always paranoid about.
Yeah.
And makes it intelligible as like a socialization practice instead of like a criminal practice, right? So it kind of gives, your whole book kind of gives Friday a new like sense of gravitas for me, which I was happy about. Now I want to go watch it.
Good, I'm glad. Yeah, I love that movie. And yeah, a lot of, and I mean, to be clear also, it was kind of a hindsight moment as I was working through it too, where I was like, oh, that's what this movie was up to.
Yeah, it's just, it's an interesting aside.
Yeah. But it also speaks to, you know, I think the legibility of communal practices across positionalities and how often illegible they are. And, you know, illegibility, you know, is often an invitation to violence, right? To feeling threatened. And that in many respects, you know, is, I mean, kind of the history of gangsta in so many ways, right? I mean, going even when we're talking about like Fuck the Police or other tracks that, you know, so much of the genre was working within this kind of signifying tradition, right? That it was not intended to be taken literally, right? But you know, the folks who were not in on the joke also happened to be among the most powerful people in U.S. civil society at the time. And that manifested as Senate hearings, as, you know, parental advisory stickers, and a ramped up war on crime.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you remember a couple of years ago, well, when Trump, I don't know if he'd been elected, but maybe it was just toward the very end of the election campaign, but Snoop Dogg made a anti-Trump diss track, and it was like not Trump, but you like could tell it was Trump, and he fired, he like pointed his finger and like fired a like fake gun at him. And Trump wanted him prosecuted under some kind of hate speech law for like basically essentially like tantamount to threatening the murder of the president.
Right.
Yeah. And it was just like, see, this is so ironic because, and yet meanwhile, multiple times at my institution the last couple of years, people have worn blackface, quote unquote, as a joke or quote unquote, ironically, as if I don't know what irony is. And it's totally, the only people who are mad about it are black folks. Right. Because for white people, it's like, well, it was ignorant and stupid, but it's just performative. It's like, well, can you just make the same argument about gangster rap then?
You can, but they don't want to, right?
But we don't. Yeah. Yeah. Can you? Yeah. Brian's like, yeah. In fact, I did make the argument. It's this book you're interviewing me about. Did you not remember? That's what we were doing.
No. I'm just saying that, like, I mean, it's, I mean, all the available evidence is there, right? To suggest that. Yeah. Yeah. It's like playful. I mean, thinking back again to the Trayvon Martin example, right? I mean, yeah, he was tweeting pictures of himself wearing grills, flicking off the camera, you know, using kind of gangster vernacular right. practices. And I'm still pretty convinced he was better behaved at his age than I was.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really right. Yeah.
But it gets labeled not as, you know, a 17-year-old being a 17-year-old, right. That, you know, just a teenager talking shit on Twitter, right. Like I,
yeah, just right. Exactly.
Truly would have done myself. Rather it becomes this, you know, indicator of Martin being always already criminal and therefore warranting Zimmerman's suspicion and violence.
Right. Yeah. Gosh. Well, that was a bummer note to end it on. We went from G-Funk barbecues. And of course, we didn't even get to talk about the Regulator song, which is the absolute best song of that era to me.
It is damn good.
Yeah. Well, and we're coming up on an hour, and I always hate to abuse the listeners' time by keeping going, but this was just, it's just, and also I will say though, the fact that we've barely skimmed on some of the more specific instantiations of the mark of criminality in the book does kind of speak to the depth and the richness of the book, which is another reason why people should, if they were intrigued by the interview, actually go out and read it for themselves. So before we sort of get into that like closing line though, do you want to say anything else about the book or bring out anything else that you found especially captivating or interesting to talk about?
I mean, in terms of the way it, I guess it kind of informed me and, you know, in addition to my approach to just kind of scholarship and studying anti-blackness and race more broadly, was kind of this question of, of travel, of movement, of capture, of escape as kind of a heuristic, and, you know, a way of really, yeah, I think anyone who studies, you know, rhetoric or some other mode of public discourse, you know, if you tell them, okay, crime is socially constructed, et cetera, would be like a no-brainer, but to kind of actually kind of take stock in what that really means and what that entails, right, is I think quite rich, not just in terms of the way we read public discourse, but also kind of in the way we just kind of occupy space and live lives, right? You know, for instance, you know, myself and my partner, we have, you know, over the course of our lives lived in cities, and parts of cities that are, you know, widely associated with violent crime. You know, before moving to Louisiana, we lived in Detroit. We lived for a year in New Orleans. Now we live in Baton Rouge, right? These are all cities with high, you know, what are measured as high crime rates and are largely associated with high crime rates. And yeah, I mean, all of that stuff's accurate as far as it goes, right? I mean, I sometimes hear gunshots, right? I also know that that has nothing to do with me, right? So I don't know if you're familiar with Nextdoor, the app, right? I think, oh man, it's wild. I mean, if you want to see the market criminality playing out in terms of kind of white iterations of it, do or don't download Nextdoor. But it's basically like an app that you download. So people, it's basically like a neighborhood Facebook. Yeah. You know? So I mean, it's functional in some ways in that people can post things they want to sell, or, you know, they have
questions. Oh, okay. I thought it was like for
snitching. Well, no, it's for that too, because there's a crime and safety section of it, right?
Ah, so you post.
Yeah, okay. So it's just like, hey, I saw these two black teenagers riding their bikes around at, you know, 1 a.m. I'm Jeez. Like, you want to know what I was doing at 1 a.m. when I was 16? Man,
I know.
I mean, those performatives are still very much available, and they, you know, maybe people are not having knockdown dragouts in public life with regard to the content of rap lyrics, they are still reading bodies in very particular ways and seeing them as threats, and just, you know, the kind of intense kind of vulnerability that often the least vulnerable bodies can feel, right, when encountering racial difference. It's pretty astonishing, and I think that's why, you know, I was glad I was pushed to attend to affect, right, in the project, because it's felt, right, it's very intense, and that's something to take seriously, because without attending to that element of it, I don't know that we stand a chance at confronting and hopefully stopping it.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah, and there is for my affect people in the audience, there's a lot to like about this book. I'm a discourse person, so I always go straight to the language. But yeah, if you like that feeling stuff, no, I'm just kidding. No, I mean, and it is important, right? Because whatever the counter is to this is going to have to tap into the fact that this is a felt experience on both ends, not just a discursive and the like in the old school version of it. Yeah, well, it was a fabulous book. I wish we had more time because we could talk about this, but, you know, and some hosts do, they go 2 hours to talk about a book, but I just, like, I couldn't listen for that long. Plus, honestly, at this point, we've covered everything. I think that's the essential themes, and really the rest of this really needs to be a read experience, because there is something kind of lost in conversing about a book that you wrote to be read. And also the images. I mean, there's a lot of really fascinating images in here. There's album covers, and there's different kind of like screenshots of various mark of criminality practices. And you're just not going to get a lot of that from this discussion. But I think we've squeezed out from it what we could for an hour.
Oh, yeah. Great. I had a blast.
Yeah, it was awesome. Well, once again, I'll just remind everyone that Brian's book, The Mark of Criminality, is available from the University of Alabama Press. It's also on Amazon, as all things are these days. And if you're not interested in buying a copy for yourself, we always do like to recommend. We'd love to support our university presses, especially Alabama keeps their rhetoric series going strong. So you can always reach out to your public or university library, college library, and recommend that they pick up a copy. And I do think this is the kind of book that would have a lot of public purchase. So even at public libraries, you know, recommending that they kind of keep these books on hand Even if you don't necessarily want to read them yourself, can be a great way to circulate the book and circulate the ideas among a general audience. And so I guess we'll wrap up with asking you if you have any books you'd like to recommend for us to interview on another episode of the New Books Network.
I would. Obviously, there are a lot of choices. A lot of people are doing really important work. But one I just recently read and had the pleasure of sitting on a panel about at a recent conference is Ursula Orr's new book, Lynching, Violence, Rhetoric, and American Identity. She makes some really powerful arguments about lynching as a cultural form that is central to the production of American identity. It's a brilliant work. It's a devastating work. It's a remarkably well-written book by a scholar who is, I think, a top-notch intellect and a marvelous human being as well. So her book definitely warrants a lot of attention, especially. Well, I'm hard pressed to think of a time when it wouldn't, but it feels timely, and it feels
well. And it's a great follow up to this book. So I will get in touch with Ursula and see if maybe can I name drop you? You think that'll get me in the door?
Oh yeah, yeah, by all means. So I mean,
people just do not like, they just avoid their emails like crazy.
True. Well, especially now with summer, we're all just like, okay, later.
Yeah, I know. I don't expect a lot of interviews coming out in the summer because I can't get people on the horn. Well, Brian, thank you for the recommendation. It was awesome to talk to you. And I just really thoroughly enjoyed this book. So thank you from the bottom of my heart for writing it. I hope it gets the wide circulation that it deserves. And you got another book coming out next week or a year from now? Like when's the next one?
I don't have a deadline on any of them. I've kind of got three working ideas for books, but I'm working on
many books left to come.
One's co-authored and then two are sole authored, but
that's exciting.
Yeah, I'm jazzed. I'm working on one over the summer and then I'm doing some archive work for another. I'm on sabbatical in the fall. So that's what I'll be doing.
Oh, cool. Well, keep us posted when it's out. You can be my second repeat of all time. And then maybe my first three-peat if you really get on it.
All right. I will. That's some motivation. I'll get at it.
All right. Well, it was great talking to you. Have a great, restful summer. And I guess if I don't see you before NCA, I'll see you in November.
Sounds perfect.
All right. Take care, Brian.
Thanks, Lee. Bye.